Hiya, and welcome to Brain Injury Bites, where we provide help and advice for people after a brain injury. My name's Brooke, and I've lived with a traumatic brain injury since 2007.
Hi, I'm Ashwini, and I'm a trustee at Headway Warrington. I'm also a senior associate solicitor focusing on catastrophic injury, including brain injury.
We're delighted to welcome Suzanne Guest. Suzanne is an occupational psychologist working in the Greater Manchester area, and you run a company, Work in Mind. So thank you, Suzanne, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
So, Suzanne, it'd be really helpful for our listeners to understand a little bit more about who you are and what you do. I don't think many of our listeners will have come across occupational psychologists in the normal scheme of things.
Yeah, so I work mainly with people who've had acquired brain injuries and help them go back to work. So most people think I'm an occupational therapist, which I think is probably a cooler job than what I've got. But my main work is looking at the work I enjoy the most is working on job retention, which is helping somebody go back to the job that they would have had before. And what I do is I work with a person who's had the injury and find out what the difficulties are, and more importantly, find out what their strengths are and help to support them to go back to work. So that will mean looking at what the job involves, looking at how we can compensate for any difficulties, and also supporting the employer to support that person back to work.
And yeah, so you mentioned an emphasis on somebody's strengths in particular, because I'm guessing that often, maybe not always, people can't necessarily return to the job that they were doing before. So I guess you're looking a lot at transferable skills and qualifications, interests, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think sometimes what happens is that when somebody's had an injury, we spend so much time talking about memory deficits and problem solving deficits and social problems and physical problems, but we do miss out that that person had skills before and they've still retained some of those skills, they still retain those interests. So it's looking at what that person's retained. Sometimes people develop new skills after they've had a brain injury because they might find that actually they're a lot more empathic than they were before their injury. Or they've developed different sorts of organisational skills because of all the strategies that they use. So it's then looking at transferring that back into a workplace.
And I'm just thinking about someone like Brooke, for example. So Brooke, as you may know, sustained his injury whilst he was still at university, so hadn't actually entered the job market. Do you work with people like Brooke?
Yeah, so I work with people who have had an acquired injury and support with work or meaningful activity. Most of my work is job retention, so people who are already in work. But I do work with people who either can't go back to the work they've had or are at the very start of the career and look at finding work experience for people. So it could be that somebody's had no idea of what they wanted to do. And I don't know if this was the case for you or not, Brooke, if you'd got a clear path of where you was going or...
No, I've never had a clear path of anything in my life, and then stick a brain injury in there and it's the path gets a lot more.
Yeah, but I think sometimes people can have really rigid ideas of what they want and either it's not realistic or it wasn't what they thought it was going to be. And I think sometimes finding opportunities and being open to what comes into your path is actually really productive for some people. So, you know, did you think when you had your brain injury, actually, I'm going to be on a podcast?
You have expectations for yourself and you think you're going to go in some sort of direction. I didn't have the exact path planned out, but one of my friends, Graham, he's gone on to work in construction. He's working in London, lived in London. I felt like we lived together, went traveling together, went to uni together. And I feel that I would have followed the same path. I think I would have gone down to London. And actually at the time went back to Scarborough, which is exactly what I didn't want to do in my life. I think it's important to do something with your life is really important, because I think if you have too much free time, it really does eat you, and that's when the depression starts. And I think the first thing I ever did that was of any use was I did a 10K run. I raised some money for it, and I think that was the started me on the path that I'm on of raising money and going back into helping people. So you need to focus on something. And you need to think that you're making a difference in this world, because I just thought that's one of the things that really got me. I just thought, sorry to be brutal, but if I died tomorrow, apart from my parents and my family, immediate family and friends, who would miss me, what...
I suppose, what have you done? What have you contributed?
What have I contributed to this earth, yeah. And that's what started me off and, you know, raising some money. It might not seem a lot to a lot of people, but it was. It made me feel better for... I've made a positive contribution to the world.
Yeah. I think the point that you're making and what you've you were saying is that it's got to be meaningful. So it's about finding something that will give your clients a purpose, a reason to get up in the morning.
That was something that someone said that to me, a reason to get up in the morning. That's what, apart from watching Jeremy Kyle, of course.
That's not a reason to get up in the morning.
No, and there is things about looking at what's right for that person. So as a fluffy psychologist, I always want to get somebody to a position that they really love their job and it's something that, you know, they wake up and they click their heels and it's what they want to do. But there are people who their main motivation for working is about the finances for them. And, you know, I remember working with a guy who was a really high earner. And he was talking, he was very financially driven. But when you drill down into that, actually, it was about security for him. So it wasn't just about putting a sharp suit on and, you know, putting more money into a savings account. It was about security for his family. So even when there is the kind of things that are a bit less fluffy, often there are human reasons behind wanting more money. It's not just purely about wanting a bigger house or a bigger car for him.
It was the image as well, I think. Of, you want to look good to your peers, don't you? And there's people that you went to school with and you want to have, you know, appeared to do, well, if you have that school reunion, you want to have done well, don't you? And you don't want to be someone that's not done well, so...
But I think it also comes back to what we discussed in the last series about self-esteem, the importance of self-esteem and, you know, what you do for, I think most adults in some sort of occupation, it largely defines who you are as a person because you spend so much time of your week in work. So once something comes along, like a traumatic brain injury that takes that away or takes it away temporarily, it can have a huge impact on your self-esteem, your sort of sense of self. And particularly then if that person's not able to return to what they were doing before, that's going to have a huge, I imagine, psychological impact on
Because work provides so much for people, even if you're in a job that you don't like and you don't particularly value. So there's potentially, there's first of all, obviously, there's an income, but then there's things like social contacts. So there's people who are in jobs that they don't particularly like, but they've got friends there.
Yeah, of course.
It's often the way that somebody would identify themselves. It's a huge use of your time. So like Brute was just saying about, you know, wondering who'd miss him or, you know, not having time to fill, work actually does provide that. So it's a huge, you know, how 30, 40, 50, 60, however many hours people end up working. It's a huge hole in somebody's life when work's doing
well. It's one of the first questions as well, isn't it? Who I am, Suzanne, what do you do?
If you
stumble on the first hurdle, then it's a bad thing.
We are very much defined by what we do. It's very much a topic of conversation, and it is that sense of purpose, as we were saying, to have something. Before I just expand on that a little bit more, I just wanted to, out of curiosity, ask you if there was a difference between occupational psychology, which is what you do, and vocational rehabilitation.
Well, occupational psychology actually covers a really broad area. So there's people who work in occupational psychology who do things like the assessment centres that graduates do, or you can work on recruitment, you could work within doing things like team building and things like that. So it's, occupational psychology is basically the psychology of work. It doesn't necessarily need to involve somebody who's had an injury or anything like that. So vocational rehabilitation is basically using work as a form of rehabilitation, potentially after injury, but it could also be after somebody's been in prison or somebody's had drug issues and things like that. It doesn't necessarily need to be.
Rejoining the world, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. No, interesting. And I didn't think about that occupational psychology is much more than working with people with injuries. So you talk about working with the individual, looking at their strengths, working with employers as well. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that in terms of the liaison that you have with employers? Presumably you're talking to managers, HR. What sort of discussions do you have, and do you come across any sort of challenges, barriers with that?
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to paint the employer as being the bad guy. And very rarely are they. So occasionally there's somebody they don't want back and they would be quite obstructive. And they very rarely say, we don't want this person back. So they will throw barriers in the way. But one of the things that I think we very often forget about in this whole process is that the employer, particularly the line manager or the colleague, will be somebody who maybe has worked with that person for many years. Mm. And then suddenly, one morning, they will get a call to say that their colleague is in intensive care.
Yeah.
And I don't think we think about how shocking that is for the employees. And I've had ones who've said, we just didn't know what to do. We didn't want to bother the family, but we didn't want them to think we weren't bothered either.
Mm.
And I think sometimes there is that looking at sorting that communication out. So I've had survivors say to me, do you know, I was off and they didn't ring up, and the employees are saying, we didn't want to bother them.
Yeah,
and it wasn't that they didn't care, they didn't know what to do.
Yeah, so, I suppose they didn't want to do something that might put them in a difficult position legally as well.
Yeah. So I think the employees are often in a really, really difficult position. So we're looking at facilitating communication between the person who's off work and the employer. And it's often about just finding the right person. So we need to have contact with the line manager and usually HR. I do often have people, and one of their concerns is, how am I going to explain to people while I'm off? Because we know brain injury is the hidden disability. So I had a guy once who ran the London Marathon before he went back to work. Not on the day, but, you know, sort of, just whip round London and then. But
sounds like the kind of thing Brooke would do, but yeah.
Well, yeah, me too. So you have somebody who's coming back, maybe looking quite fit, but what we don't see is that a couple of hours of work in an office that might be brightly lit, staring at a screen, concentrating, is exhausting.
There's all these new things. It's a really weird world to go into, because you enter this world and there's all these things that you now find really fatiguing and that you never did before, like listening, like talking to people. And
yeah.
Like there's that element of employers not really understanding anything. Like I remember when I moved back to my mum and dad's for 6 months and I had this thing, I wanted to move back to Manchester. So I moved back in with my mates. Obviously, my mates were still either at uni or working in bars. And where this thing, I wanted to go back to work. I wanted to be seen to be wanting to go back to work and not. I mean, at the time I had my injury, there was a program on TV called Benefit Street. And people I knew anyway, they were very against people on benefits. And I didn't want to be seen as one of them. So I had made an effort to go back to work just for free. And I worked in a bar. I didn't think I could handle the till. I just helped in on the day. We were moving stock about and I was exhausted. And I remember him saying to me, well, when are you gonna be all right to come back to work? And I'm like, I don't have a clue.
I think it's cognitive overload. I mean, even working in a bar, it's like all the noise and, you know, people around and just having to sequence tasks and things. But in an office environment, I can totally see how, you know, when you've taken a period of time out, and I mean, any one of us who goes on a long holiday comes back and goes, how do I do my job?
Yeah.
But, you know, add on a brain injury and a prolonged period of time out, and it's all of a sudden it's getting used to the systems and the noise. And even things like, obviously, I imagine people's colleagues will want to talk to them, find out how they are, and that can be fatiguing as well.
At the time I was in my early 20s, and like the thing to do then was, you know, go out partying, and all of a sudden, you know, you go stay up all night and maybe even going to work the next day, and, you know, just being a student generally. But I went to, I found myself that the best environment for me would be like a well-lit with natural light, like a coffee shop on a Tuesday afternoon or something, not a nightclub at 3 o'clock in the morning. So it's weird having to adjust to that as well. Having your friends not
understanding.
Having your friends not understanding that as well, and trying to help you along.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is really important is doing brain injury education with the employers.
Yeah.
So getting them to understand about memory problems. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll get people very well-meaning saying, you don't need those diaries. Just if you just focus and you just think about it, you'll not need to keep writing things down. When obviously the strategies and the writing things down helps take that demand off.
Yeah.
You want it to be like, to fit back in as well. You'll just say, yeah, I agree with it. And then you take them diaries away and then, you're in trouble.
So one of the things that I give employers is one of the fact sheets that's produced by Headway UK, which is a guide for employers. And that talks about how some of the difficulties associated with brain injury and also some of the strategies. Because I think when we talk about reasonable adjustments, people always think that, well, it's putting a ramp to the door and it's lowering things and it's all very expensive. And sometimes it's as simple as somebody learning to organise their emails into different folders or having a little meeting at the beginning of the day or the week to plan what somebody's going to do or structuring breaks differently. Yeah. It's not necessarily anything that's massively expensive.
It's bespoke to that person.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's also then creating those habits and habit loading so that, you know, that becomes embedded and somebody gets used to having those meetings in the morning or organising their emails that way so that it makes it easier to get through the day.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is really important to remember, though, is that people with brain injury, one of the things they often struggle most with is change. And workplaces tend to be changing environments.
Oh, yes.
So we don't always realise that the little changes that are creeping up. So it could be that a manager changes, IT changes all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's having somebody who will be aware that something different, that the person with the brain injury maybe would need a little bit of extra time. Yeah.
It's like if they've had one in the last few years and then all of a sudden you have to get used to QR codes.
Yeah.
Like, what are they?
Yeah. And what do you do when that is? I don't get why people put them on things that you would look at on your phone, because how do you scan it when it's on your phone?
Yeah.
I know.
Do you have to hold your phone up and scan it from another phone?
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, you could selfie it in the mirror, maybe. Will it work back to front?
I have no idea.
We shouldn't have to put that much effort into it, should you?
Exactly. It's just give me a link. I know what a link is. I can click on a link. But an example I had several years ago, I don't think I ended up working with this person, but I can remember speaking to the employer who this person was in a kind of sheltered workplace, and they kept losing their temper and they would allow that because they got problems. But they introduced a new signing in system that this person was forgetting because it was completely new. And they actually disciplined him for not signing in, but were not actually reining in the losing the temper because they got problems. And it was interesting that the temper was seen as a brain injury thing, but the memory wasn't. And it is those little things of, if you introduce a new system, that person with the brain injury maybe needs a few more prompts or needs it writing down or just a little bit of leeway to get used.
So in a situation like that, so let's say you have a client and, you know, you're liaising with the employer in the lead up to them going back to work, and then person goes in, but as you say, you know, workplaces change systems and processes a lot, but it's not always sort of, you know, it's not a case of it'll be every month. So how do you sort of have ongoing contacts with your clients, and how do you get involved if somebody's actually struggling with a change? Is it sort of on that person to come to you and say, I'm just really, you know, I just can't cope with this, I don't understand? Or would it be the employers that come to you and say, is there anything you can help us out with here?
It's a mixture of both. So while I'm working with somebody, I would still make contact with people regularly. That might just be dropping somebody a text saying, how are you getting on? Or it could be ringing somebody up or with the employer. Unfortunately, things do sometimes just hit crisis point rather than it being one of those situations where, oh, I'm just struggling with this a little bit. But the big thing I do always try and stress with the employers is that change is difficult following a brain injury. So, you know, think about how you implement change after a brain injury.
Yeah. And maybe look at whether that individual needs some additional support, I guess, or, you know, can we do it slightly differently to, like, with the signing in thing, I wonder whether actually, if somebody had thought about it, was there another way of helping that person to sign in or remembering to sign in? And that may not, I don't know, have alleviated some other problems.
Absolutely.
It's very interesting. I should say as well, we'll put the fact sheet that you referred to from Headway on the footnotes to the episode if anyone would like to see them. I have worked with you in a litigation context. So I know
I was a delight, wasn't I?
You still are. And so just to explain to our listeners, the context in which I've worked with Suzanne previously, currently, is as part of a what we call a multidisciplinary team, where we have a team of different rehab professionals all supporting a client with traumatic brain injury. So there'll be typically a case manager, there'll be a neuropsychologist, yourself as an occupational psychologist, we'll have an occupational therapist, because the two are different. There might be speech and language therapists, there might be physiotherapists, whatever that particular client needs. So can you just talk to us about your role within a multidisciplinary team and how you work with other professionals in terms of goal setting and, you know, moving a client towards that sort of the magical self-actualization on the Maslow's hierarchy pyramid?
It's really important to keep communication with the whole team. So the neuropsychologist will often be working with people to develop strategies. So if somebody's using a particular type of diary system at home, then it makes sense to try and transfer that to the workplace rather than have one system at home and one system at work. So that bit is important. I think one of the things as well is to, we often look at, oh, somebody's only working 3 days a week, but we're missing out that they're seeing an occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, a neuropsychologist, which are all really cognitively demanding.
Taxing on the brain,
So potentially when you add up the hours that they're working and the therapy time, you're at a full-time job. So there's looking at carrying over the strategies to the workplace. And also the other members of the team, sometimes, say, for example, if somebody's doing shopping with the occupational therapist, they might mention that something's not quite right at work, because I think when you're doing things...
Of course,
Things just come out as opposed to just sitting in a session.
Yeah.
So it's important then that they would feed back to me so I can address those issues. So we do all tend to work really closely with each other, because work impacts home and home impacts work. So we'll hopefully communicate well.
Yeah, I think that's the importance of building a really solid therapeutic relationship with the clients as well. So those nuggets of information that can be really quite key can come out in a more natural setting rather than, as you say, in a clinical sort of face-to-face, tell me about what's going on at work kind of situation. So, I think communication is key, and we've discussed that in many sort of previous episodes as well. Thinking about some of the challenges then, because you talked before about how, you know, a lot of people's drivers are sort of around financial security. It's not necessarily about the prestige of the employment. It's about being able to provide. And, you know, if you take, and I'm going to horribly stereotype here, but let's say you take a man in his 40s, you know, married, kids, the main breadwinner. And I must stress that's not always the makeup of this, but take somebody like that who suddenly can't work and, you know, was previously earning well, had a nice life. And as you say, their concern will be that financial security, being able to provide for the family and so on. But whilst they might be able to get into something that, as you said, Brooke, you know, fills their day, gives them purpose, it might not necessarily give them the same financial reward. And that must in itself impact on somebody's self-esteem. How do you manage those sorts of challenges?
Those type of things are so difficult. It is about somebody adjusting. So if there isn't any grounds for litigation, then somebody's standard of living will end up massively reduced. So we can look at trying to access benefits for people, but contrary to what certain newspapers would have you believe, you know, people on benefits don't have a lot of money. So there is looking at somebody, it might be that they need to downsize the house and make sort of quite difficult decisions. And again, that's where working with a team, where the neuropsychologist, or sometimes we get counsellors involved to work with somebody emotionally adjusting to what is a very different type of life. And that can also include the family. So if that somebody's married and they've had very different roles and suddenly that dynamics change, and potentially at some point the partner becomes a carer, and we know that children can find it difficult if a parent's had a brain injury and suddenly things are very different for them and they take on a bit of a caring role or potentially they might be a bit embarrassed by the parent. All kids are embarrassed by the parents at some point. That's a given, isn't it? But I think there's a point that, you know, if somebody's a bit disinhibited and they're at school, then, you know, we can work with children on getting them to understand why their parents are a bit different.
And what about, say, somebody who is able to return to work but not doing what they previously did? Can that have an impact? Or rather, I suppose what you do is you do a lot of groundwork beforehand to help manage that transition. But what kind of things would you do?
Well, first of all, it's looking at, we would initially try and get somebody back to their original job. If that isn't possible, it could be that we would look at, are there different jobs within that employer's? And that's a bit of a double-edged sword. So the positives are things like they're with people who potentially would be quite supportive. They're in a familiar environment. The downside could be if somebody's taking a lower grade than they had before. So I worked with a man who, he ended up working under people who he'd previously supervised. So that changed.
That's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, so that he found that really difficult.
So they're kind to him.
Yeah.
Depends on whether he was kind to him in the first place, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think he actually was a really hardworking guy, but he had quite difficult social problems after his brain injury. So I think a lot saw that his issues were around his brain injury, but he was very focused at work. Now, if that, and for some people, it is just intolerable working in a lower grade in the same employer. So that's when, you know, you look at finding something very different, it could be, and it's about adjustment and starting a new life for them.
And I guess that's where, again, the importance of the multidisciplinary team comes in, because you'd also have the psychologists working alongside, you know, and counselling and that sort of thing. And I suppose it's finding, as you say, purpose and meaning in the activity that they're engaged in as well. So, but it's a big adjustment, no doubt.
Yeah, and I do think one of the things that can really help with that is headway groups. So somebody meeting other people who are maybe a bit further on in their injury. Think like the work that Brooke does. I first saw you speaking at a conference about your journey of, you know, this is where I was, this is where I am now, is an important factor in somebody's adjustment.
Yeah, and realising that you're not alone.
Yeah.
Don't remember that. that's a symptom, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was many years ago.
I was going to say, I first saw you at a Miller sort of conference, but yeah, that would have been many years ago. I think you've just done so many of them in fairness. But, you know, don't underestimate the importance of that, telling your story. That's your purpose, I guess, coming back to what we were saying
that
before.
That was something my mum said to me, actually, that when she was in Salford Royal Hospital, and she said that if she could have seen somebody like me, you know, further down the line, that would have given her so much hope then. And I've kind of always kind of endeavoured to do something like that, just to be an example to people of, because it is rubbish, and it is rubbish for a long time. Well, you know, everyone's got a different experience, haven't they? But it does get better, and I think it does. You've got to work hard at it, but it, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Thank you for listening to part one. We hope you can join us for part two. Please don't forget to follow, subscribe and share our content. If you do have any suggestions for topics that you'd like us to cover, why not drop us a line at hi@braininjurybites.co.uk.